White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to another episode of the International Jew Study Hour with Carolyn Yeager and Hadding Scott.
Hello,
Hadding. We're so glad that you're here, and I certainly am. And it is October 18th, and this is episode 17 already. I can't really keep up with the numbers of the episodes. I always think we're back a few before that. But this week, Hadding, before we get started in the chapter, which is going to be chapter 14. We're already in episode 17, though. We took us 2 weeks to do, well, a week and a half to do the last chapter. But I want to start out again with a little detour here tonight before we start this chapter 14. Because this week a listener sent me an email saying he didn't understand why you were so adamant that the protocols were a forgery. And he relayed to me the work of Peter Myers, who is an Australian, I think. Some of our listeners might be familiar with Peter Myers. I knew of him, and I have known of him for quite some time. He does an exhaustive amount of work on certain subjects, well, on a lot of subjects, actually, but it's always usually more than I have time to read and spend time on. But he sent some stuff that Peter Myers had done on the protocols, and I eventually got around to reading the part that I was most interested in, which was the Maurice Joly comparison and the part of the protocols that's what you mostly bring up. And so I made some notes that were really cut down to bare bones what he said, and it really is sufficient because he makes a few major points as to his position is that he believes the protocols are authentically, you know, are not a forgery. They're not a forgery. I don't know what you'd call what they are, but that he says it's a probabilistic thing. Rather than a sure thing, because it's, you know, that's as much as he can get together. But he has an argument, and he has engaged several Jews who have books and so on out about how it is a forgery, and he says he has refuted and contradicted or counter argued everything, all their points, and they're not able to come back and answer him really properly. So he's sticking with his position. And to find out what that is, I'm going to just try to go through this pretty quickly. And I'll tell you, I've got like three major points from him. But first, he says that the protocols appear to shed light on the social revolutionary movement and the one world forces. He says one cannot understand 20th century history without this book. It's in leading university and national libraries. Yeah, and this is kind of what the International Jew is going to be arguing too, if they're not really arguing, but setting forth in this chapter that we're going to be reading. So this is real timely to go into this right now. So he says our task is not cheap propaganda, but a deep investigation of the social revolution afflicting the West at present and tracing its roots back several centuries. So the point he's making is that this is a serious subject, and we need all the help we can get, I guess, and we need to investigate how these roots went back as to what is afflicting us now. And this is what the International Jew is saying too. Okay, I've got this underlined, must be important. He says, this requires study of not only the French and Bolshevik revolutions, but the revolutions of 1848 and 1871, the Paris Commune and the regime of Emperor Napoleon III of France, against which Maurice Joly wrote his dialogues in Hell between Machiavelli and Montesquieu, published in 1864, of course, before the protocols are said to have come out or even been prepared, actually, which has much in common with the protocols of Zion. And that's all true, and he has tons of information about Emperor Napoleon III and those revolutions and all kinds of stuff in there. He says that Emperor Napoleon III of France was sandwiched between two attempted communist revolutions, and Joly, one of the revolutionaries, directed his dialogues book against the emperor. So he says in the context of Joly's dialogues is the choice between revolution and Napoleon. So he sees Joly as on the side of the revolutionaries, because he was so opposed to Napoleon III. Napoleon III represented what? The monarchical forces, which the protocols of Zion are wanting to tear down, you know, according to what's in the protocol.
No, not really. That's not really that's an oversimplification. The Bonapartists were, Napoleon Bonaparte was a Freemason, and culmination of the French Revolution, more or less, and he was on the left, and he was a kind of a leftist emperor, and Napoleon III was the same thing. He did things like start allowing Algerians to immigrate into France.
Well, still, but yeah, he did a lot of things that were bad for the nation, didn't he? But still, Joly was against Napoleon.
He also made the Catholics.
Joly was against Napoleon, so the revolutionaries are simply those who wanted to get rid of Napoleon III. You know, and so it probably the underlying meaning here is that the Jews were using this situation to overthrow Napoleon III for whatever reason people might want to be doing it.
Napoleon III has often been viewed as a tool of the Jews. Some people even like to say that he spoke French with a Yiddish accent. I don't think that's really accurate, but that's an illustration.
Okay. Well, anyway, what's his name? Peter Myers says that that in the context of the dialogues, the choice is between the revolution and Napoleon, and that. He says Napoleon III will thus be a central figure in our study, which he does make him to be. And I'm almost getting to his first major point. Okay, the parallel passages in Joly's dialogues. And I put this in the comments section at the White Network for last week's show, and it was commented on, well, by you. I don't know if anybody else commented on it, but I also gave the links so that people could go and read this stuff on their own. I don't know if any didn't get any more talk about it in the comments, but the parallel passages in Joly's dialogues comprise 16.45% of the protocols by word count. This is substantial, but still less than 1/6 of the total. You know, I have to go along with that. I mean, it is substantial, but there's 5/6 of it that's not from Joly, so we have to think about where that comes from. Okay,
there are other sources.
It's not like. Well, okay, we'll look at that. Now he's bringing up one of these, the most recent of the Jew, most recent in the timeline of the Jews who are arguing against the protocols in a big way, you know, I mean, writing books and so on. And this is Norman Cohn, C-O-H-N. He especially omits to mention, Peter says, that protocols' extensive coverage of the world finance system unmatched in the dialogue. So all the stuff about the world finance system, which really is more modern, you know, refers to what has happened in finance, is not in the dialogues. It's not in Joly's dialogues at all. So he's just making that point. Then, and he says that the parallel passages, that means the passages in Joly that appear in the protocols as being the same and therefore forged, that's 1/6 one-sixth part of it, are not the same. He says they're not always the same. They're not word for word. The meaning is often quite different. Yeah, well, the meaning is often quite different despite the similarity. Okay. I didn't find those parallel passages set up anywhere. He does give you the whole Jolie thing in translation. But I didn't know I wasn't going to make my own comparisons with the protocols. That would have taken me forever. I'd still be working on it, so I didn't do that. So I don't know about that, but I have to take people's word for it. So now he says, my argument is that Jolie did not create these parallel passages ex nihilo, or, you know, on his own, out of his own head, you know, but modified an existing revolutionary text, which was called, in parentheses, a precursor of the protocols, reworking parts of it to suit his attack on Napoleon III. Now, that's his first main argument. And I don't know if I should take the time to say what Nahum Goldman wrote after World War II. I don't think I will, unless you bring up a big point that makes me go back to that. But then he says, the parallels between Jolie's dialogues and Jacob Venedi's earlier book, well, there are parallels, as you know, between Jolie's dialogues and an earlier book, Jacob Venedi's book, Machiavel, Montesquieu, and Rousseau. So some of Jolie took material from that book, which I think you've mentioned yourself. So some of it would come from there earlier, and then well, there you go. Some things matter and some things don't, depending on what argument you make. So then he says another thing that some people make important is that, you know, well, the Jews make it important that the Tsar Nicholas had dismissed the protocols as a forgery. They make a big deal out of that, but it's but it's also said that the Tsarina had, where they were in exile, she had only three books with her, only three books, and one of them was the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. So why would she have that book with her at the time that they were executed, if the Tsar had dismissed the protocols?
And that's according to whom?
Well, I read that in a couple of places, but like I say, I can't, you know, I haven't gone and proven any of this. I haven't gone and sourced this, but this is what Peter Meyer says, and I saw it somewhere else. But it might have been in the material that he had there, you know, probably was. He has tons of source material there. If you really wanted to make an argument with him, you'd have to go and see what he's got there. Which is more than I can do. But anyway, he says, now here's another argument. My argument then, he says, is that both the protocols and Jolie used a document like Q, unknown to us. Well, he wrote a whole bunch, but I had actually read about this earlier. I had gone into this when I was studying Bible, the historical Bible, and in the New Testament, you're talking about the Gospels, the four Gospels, and how they're similar, how they're different, and why they all came up with something a little different, and who was was there an original gospel document that they all depended on? And biblical scholars, and I mean, you know, the majority of them have accepted, that doesn't mean they're right, but they have accepted that there is some kind of a gospel Q or document, they just call it Q, you know, rather than X or something, that these things were all based on. So
yeah, I read a book by Enoch Powell that argued that the Matthew and Luke Gospels were both derivative of the Mark Gospel.
Yeah, that's one thing that some people say. But this is I know that after years and years of all kinds of scholarship by these biblical scholars, you know, I mean, they really get into it, big names and all that stuff. They have fairly well agreed that there was something called Document Q. So Peter Myers is just saying that he's using that same kind of idea that he thinks, and he can't say what it is, but he's pointing out that they can't say. These big biblical scholars cannot find this Document Q. They don't know what it, you know, they don't have it, but yet they all believe that there was such a thing. So Myers is saying that concerning the protocols and the Jolie book, that they both used a document that was a prior document that is unknown to us, and he doesn't know what it is, and nobody knows what it is, but he thinks that this document would have circulated amongst leaders of some of the secret societies operating
in Europe. Pure speculation.
Well, so is the idea that it's a forgery is not proven.
No, it's not, because what he's actually admitting that it's not what it was purported to be. If he's going to say,
well, what about? Would you say the same of the gospel scholars that they're admitting that they don't know what they're talking about because they're just speculating on this document Q?
If they admit that the Matthew gospel is derivative of the Mark gospel.
Well, you know, you have your own. See, what's going on here, though? I shouldn't be interrupting you. I really shouldn't. But you have an argument, and you don't want to really fairly acknowledge on the other side.
It's a very simple point, which is if he's going to admit that parts of the protocols are derived from some earlier source, and that it's older than Maurice Joly's Dialogues in Hell,
mm-hmm.
then he's admitting that it does not represent minutes of a meeting of Zionist Jews in the 1890s.
Oh, I think so.
What's to be.
Well, let me continue, because he may have some kind of an answer to that in here. Okay. He says the success of the protocols before the war, this is more, okay, was in fact limited. And there's a guy named Zhevikov, who, well, now this again ends up being, you know, hearsay from first person hearsay, because we don't know, but this is Zhevikov tells who he knew Nihlus, and he tells how in 1913 Nihlus complained to him, and this is what Zhevikov says. Nihlus said, I cannot get the public to treat the protocols seriously with the attention they deserve. They are read, criticized, often ridiculed, but there are very few who attach importance to them and see in them a real threat to Christianity, a program for the destruction of the Christian order and for the conquest of the whole world by the Jews. That nobody believes. That's the end of the quote, which is in somewhere. It gives the page number and so on. But this is just what this guy says. Peter says, if it were a forgery designed to stir up pogroms, this kind of makes sense. Which means if it was anti-Semitic, if it was people who hated Jews who wrote this, and you know, this protocols document, and the desire was to stir up pogroms against the Jews, one would think that the forgers had failed, since it had no effect for 20 years. Because he is saying that for 20 years, nobody paid any attention to it. And then they say it was only when World War I, from 1914 to 1918, the Bolshevik Revolution, which was dated 1917, the Balfour Declaration, 1917, and the attempt to make the League of Nations a world government at the Peace Conference of Versailles, 1919, seemed to bear out predictions in the protocols, predictions which are not in Joly's dialogues, that the protocols was taken seriously. So he's saying after these certain events actually happened, then people looked at the protocols again and said, you know, and this is not stuff that was in Joly's dialogues. So his final thing.
I think we're not in Joly's dialogue. That's really not the point. The argument is not that the whole thing is derived from Maurice Joly. The argument is, since it has passages that seem to be plagiarized from Joly, it is not the minutes of a meeting.
Well, if that's the only argument that if that's all you're arguing, then all you're saying is that it's presented as minutes of a meeting, but it has a different source. That doesn't mean that it's not a plan of the Jews, does it? I mean, I'm just saying that there's nothing hard on either side. There's nothing hard or fast on either side of this.
It means there's no evidence for it. You're back to basically what Neela says as a caveat, which is we don't know what who wrote this. We really don't know. We can't say. It pretends to be, you know, minutes of a Zionist conference from, what, 1896? And it's not that. I mean, Peter Myers there admits that it's not that. He doesn't admit it directly, but indirectly he admits it. It's not that.
Well, yeah, I think he indirectly admits that. He's not claiming that.
It's a work.
But he thinks that it's an authentic plan of a world government that would come from the Jews, and there's lots of there's lots of things there that show what the Jews were doing this, you know, long before different plans like this, you know, different spouting out stuff like this, you know.
Okay, he takes some liberties there. He said that the protocols have been around 20 years before anybody took them seriously. He's taking as authentic the claim that they'd been around since 1896. The earliest appearance,
was 1905, something like that, yeah. Right. 1905 or something?
1903, it says on
1903, okay. 1903 when the book was known. When Dallas introduced them, right? Okay, all right. Okay, now my last thing here, which is really interesting, because some people have written to me about your saying that the Jews didn't control the Bolshevik Revolution. They didn't control the Bolshevik Party and so on. And before you answer that, let me just say that Peter says about it. Somewhere it says here, and this actually maybe comes from Russell. This comes from Russell, and there's Bertrand Russell. There's a paper. There's a link here to Bertrand Russell, HTML. The same people who denied Jewish control of the Bolshevik Revolution until Stalin stole their conspiracy also deny the authenticity of the protocols. Therefore, demonstrating this Jewish control is the first step in puncturing their argument. Isn't that interesting? Because you
did
both of those things.
The Bolshevik movement. I didn't say that. What I said was that the mainstream of my essential point was the Jews do not want autocracy. They do not want to have a Jewish autocrat, because if they have a Jewish autocrat, then Jews are held responsible for what happens. If they have a puppet autocrat that's not a Jew, there's always the risk that the puppet autocrat will turn against them.
Yeah, that's true. But that's a good point. But you did say that the Bolsheviks, it's a little hard to remember exactly what you said, but you were saying that because several people wrote to me and said, why is he saying that? And I don't know why they don't write to you, why they write to me. But why are you saying that? It sounded to them like you were saying that the Jews were not behind the Bolshevik Revolution.
Well, no, it's more complicated than that. The Jews, the leading Bolsheviks were Jews, but the mainstream of Jewry were not Bolsheviks. Most of Jews in Russia supported the Mensheviks, which meant that they wanted to follow Orthodox Marxism, which would allow the liberal system to go on and on and on. They prefer liberalism. The Jews prefer liberalism.
It's never the main body of the Jews. It's these Jewish leaders, these Jewish controllers that are really pulling all this stuff together. So, I don't think that's kind of a wiggle out. That's sort of a wiggle out thing. Huh?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by that. The Bolshevik... Most Jews were Mensheviks in Russia. They preferred liberalism.
But did Jews control the Bolshevik Party and the Bolshevik Revolution?
Some Jews. The Bolshevik movement was Jewish at the top, mostly.
Okay,
Jewish Bolsheviks took over, then lots of Jews rallied around them. But it is not the Jewish preference to have a totalitarian system.
It's not whether it's a Jewish preference. It's whether it's it's whether it's the top people who are in the conspiracy or running the show or whatever. It's what they want. I don't know that you can ever say, well, you look at the general run of the Jewish people. They're not calling the shots, are they?
Well, so, Jews did rally around the Bolsheviks after they took over.
Yeah, the Jews, the main body of the Jews, you mean. They did.
But that I was arguing against the claim that Jews desire to have a Jewish autocrat. That's not how they operate.
Yeah, but he's not bringing that up. I'm just one last point here. Then do you deny Jewish control of the Bolshevik Revolution? If it's put that way, would you say you deny it or you don't deny it?
The top Bolsheviks were mostly Jews.
Okay. Well, I think so. Well, that's good to clear that up.
It was not a mainstream Jewish movement until after they succeeded.
Well, I think that Peter Myers did a pretty good job of arguing his position. I'm not saying that he's right, but he does come up with some things. And there's a lot more there, but this was what I noticed, that, you know, when he said something real clear cut, which, you know, I couldn't talk about this forever. Well, okay, do you want to have any last words before we go on to the chapter?
I think I said it, actually.
Okay. Well, I'm glad we had the opportunity to do that. Who knows where this will go from there. All right. You are the reader, and we are, ladies and gentlemen, at chapter 14. And the title is, Did the Jews Foresee the World War?
Okay. Before proceeding to a more detailed study of the connection between the written program of the documents which are called the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion and the actual program as it can be traced in real life, we shall now view those plans which were future when the protocols were uttered. It must be borne in mind, however, that what was future in 1896 and 1905 may be past today, that what was plan then may be fulfillment now. To bear this in mind will be in exact accord with the expression of Protocol 22. I have endeavored to indicate carefully the secrets of past and future events, and of those momentous occurrences of the near future toward which we are rushing in a stream of great crises. Some of those momentous occurrences have come to pass, and with them a brighter light on the question which we are studying. Question with a capital Q.
Yeah.
An illustration of this, which is fresh in the minds of all, was furnished by the Great War. Jewish comment on this series of articles has made much of the fact that one of the articles was devoted to the then prominence of the Jewish question in Germany, and it was sought to mislead the public to think that this series was really a part of subtle German after-the-war propaganda. The fact is that articles on the question in a number of countries were set aside in order to bring the question itself prominently before the minds of Americans with the least delay. The postponed articles will appear in due season, though out of their order. Germany is today, with perhaps the possible exception of the United States, the most Jew-controlled country in the world. Controlled within and from without, and a much stronger set of facts could be presented now than was presented in the original article, the facts of which were at first denied and later admitted by the Jewish spokesmen in the United States. For since that article was written, public sentiment in Germany has swept the Jews largely out of public office.
Mm-hmm.
German public opinion exerted itself to the utmost to put German political administration back into German hands. But did that liberate Germany from the Jews? Not at all. For their entrenchments stretched further and deeper than mere display of official power. Their hold on the basic industries, the finances, the future of Germany has not been loosened in the least. It is there, unmovable. In what that hold consists, the reader will be told at some convenient time.
Okay, well, you know, I'd like to point out that, you know, this is 1920, and this was around, as they said in earlier chapters of that they've done already, that the protocols were just coming into public notice. And it was after the peace conference, it seems like, which they make a lot out of, 1919, and that they are among the first here, the Ford people, among the first, but they're not the only ones who have started paying attention to this. And so they're saying that what was written was in the future. At the time, supposedly, that it said in this particular presentation of the protocols, but today may be past, and so we can look at it now and see if what they predicted or what they were saying they were going to do. They didn't predict. They said, we will do this, we will do that, or we are doing this, we are doing that, and now whether it's been done. They're going to show that they think that a whole lot of it has been done. And what's also interesting is this, the way that, what you just said here recently, that the Jews are saying that, you know, using everything they can is anti-German propaganda, and, including the German anti-Semitism against what the Jews have been doing. Well, I forget what I was going to say about that. Anyway, sorry.
Okay. Germany is mentioned now in connection with the Jews for this purpose. It will be remembered that it was from Germany that the first cry of annexations came, and it came at a time when all German war activities and war sentiment were admittedly in Jewish control. Annexations was the cry that flashed across the world one day. And back across the world from the United States, a nation that was not even a party to the war at that time, the word flashed back, no annexations. Thus, by a dramatic play, the whole question was thrust before the world.
Well, you know, I didn't understand what they were talking about with this annexations for quite a while, until I was toward the end of this chapter. But maybe I wasn't paying enough attention. But, you know, the annexations was because, you know, the protocols had said that there will be nobody will benefit from gaining territory in a war anymore. That's what they wanted, so that it would all be about money and economics, not territory. And I think we had that in the last chapter. And so this idea that they put forth and that they say here that the Jews helped to do that. That was part of their plan, was that if there is a war, there couldn't be any annexations, that nobody could take somebody else's territory gained through the war, you know, like if they won. And yet they did do that anyway. But this was the whole idea that was going on big time at that time, right? Am I right about that?
Sure. My mind was wandering for a second there.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, no annexations. They were trying to push that as a big moral question. Oh, you can't win somebody's territory through war. That was not allowed anymore. And this was a whole. This was to benefit the Jews and their economic control over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So there'll be more about that.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop interrupting now for a while.
Right. Soon the people of all countries had forgotten the blood of battle, the war profiteers, and every other vital point, and were discussing a matter which belonged to the end of the war and not the beginning, the question of annexations. Now, when it is known who were controlling the formulation of war aims in Germany and who were the chief counselors of the foreign policy of the United States at the same time, the projection of this question of annexations into the world's mind becomes interesting. Interesting, but not wholly intelligible. Not until you read the protocols do you get a full light on this. And this report of the protocols, which is now given the world, probably dates from 1896. There's absolutely ironclad proof of the date 1905. The second protocol begins on the note of war, and its opening words are these.
Well, this one is separate, so I'll read it. It is indispensable for our purpose that, as far as possible, war should bring no territorial advantages. This will shift war to an economic footing, and nations will perceive the strength of our superiority in the aid we render.
Yeah. In other words, borrowing money.
There you go.
Who was thinking between 1896 and 1905 of the new no annexations rule to be applied to war? Were you? Do you know of any statesman who was? We know that military men were concerned about the appliances and operations of any future war that might occur. We know that statesmen of the more responsible sort were working to consolidate a balance of interests that would make war extremely improbable. Who had outdistanced them all in foresight and planning sufficiently to lay down a definite program of no annexations? Fortunately, the clue to the answer was supplied to us by unquestionable Jewish sources. The American Jewish News of September 19, 1919, had an advertisement on its front page which reads thus: "When Prophets Speak," by Litman Rosenthal. "Many years ago, Nordahl prophesied that the Balfour Declaration." Litman Rosenthal, his intimate friend, relates this incident in a fascinating memoir. The article on page 464 begins, "It was on Saturday, the day after the closing of the Sixth Congress, when I received a telephone message from Dr. Herzl asking me to call on him." This fixes the time. The Sixth Zionist Congress was held at Basel in August 1903. The memoir continues, "On entering the lobby of the hotel, I met Herzl's mother, who welcomed me with her usual gracious friendliness and asked me whether the feelings of the Russian Zionists were now calmer. Why, just the Russian Zionists, Frau Herzl?" I asked. "Why do you only ask about these?" "Because my son," she explained, "is mostly interested in the Russian Zionists. He considers them the quintessence, the most vital part of the Jewish people." At this Sixth Congress, the British government, and it quotes the Jewish Encyclopedia, Volume 12, page 678, as saying, "Herzl and his agents had kept in contact with the English government." So, at this Sixth Congress, the British government had offered the Jews a colony in Uganda, East Africa. Herzl was in favor of taking it, not as a substitute for Palestine, but as a step toward it. It was this which formed the chief topic of conversation between Herzl and Litman Rosenthal in that Basel hotel. Herzl said to Rosenthal, as reported in this article, "There is a difference between the final aim and the ways we have to go to achieve this aim."
Mm-hmm. Important.
Suddenly, Max Nordau, who seems at the conference held last month in London to have become Herzl's successor, entered the room, and the Rosenthal interview was ended. Let the reader now follow attentively the important part of this Rosenthal story. Do you want to read this?
Okay. Okay, this is Rosenthal. This is part of this story that this Litman Rosenthal was telling everybody about, well, telling all the Jews about. About a month later, I went on a business trip to France. On my way to Lyon, I stopped in Paris, and there I visited, as usual, our Zionist friends. One of them told me that this very same evening, Dr. Nordahl was scheduled to speak about the Sixth Congress, and I, naturally, interrupted my journey to be present at this meeting and to hear Dr. Nordahl's report. When we reached the hall in the evening, we found it filled to overflowing, and all were waiting impatiently for the great master, Nordahl, who on entering received a tremendous ovation. But Nordahl, without paying heed to the applause showered upon him, began his speech immediately and said, go ahead and read Nordahl.
"You all came here with a question burning in your hearts and trembling on your lips. And the question is indeed a great one and of vital importance. I am willing to answer it. What you want to ask is, how could I, I, who was one of those who formulated the Basel program, how could I dare to speak in favor of the English proposition concerning Uganda? How could Herzl as well as I betray our ideal of Palestine? Because you surely think that we have betrayed it and forgotten it. Yet listen to what I have to say to you. I spoke in favor of Uganda after long and careful consideration. Deliberately, I advised the Congress to consider and to accept the proposal of the English government, a proposal made to the Jewish nation through the Zionist Congress, and my reasons. But instead of my reasons, let me tell you a political story as a kind of allegory. I want to speak of a time which is now almost forgotten, a time when the European powers had decided to send a fleet against the fortress of Sevastopol. At this time, Italy, the United Kingdom of Italy, did not exist. Italy was in reality only a little principality of Sardinia, and the great free and united Italy was but a dream, a fervent wish, a far ideal of all Italian patriots. The leaders of Sardinia, who were fighting for and planning this free and united Italy, were the three great popular heroes, Garibaldi, Mazzini, and Cavour. The European powers invited Sardinia to join in the demonstration at Sebastopol and to send also a fleet to help in the siege of this fortress. And this proposal gave rise to a dissension among the leaders of Sardinia. Garibaldi and Mazzini did not want to send a fleet to the help of England and France, and they said, "Our program, the work to which we are pledged, is a free and united Italy. What have we to do with Sebastopol? Sebastopol is nothing to us, and we should concentrate all our energies on our original program so that we may realize our ideal as soon as possible." But Cavour, who even at this time was the most prominent, the most able, and the most far-sighted statesman of Sardinia, insisted that his country should send a fleet and beleaguer with the other powers Sevastopol, and at last he carried this point. Perhaps it will interest you to know that the right hand of Cavour, his friend and advisor, was his secretary Hartum, a Jew. And in those circles which were in opposition to the government, one spoke fulminantly of Jewish treason. And once, at an assembly of Italian patriots, one called wildly for Cavour's secretary, Hartum, and demanded of him to defend his dangerous and treasonable political actions. And this is what he said: "Our dream, our fight, our ideal, an ideal for which we have paid already in blood and tears, in sorrow and despair, with the life of our sons and the anguish of our mothers. Our one wish and one aim is a free and united Italy. All means are sacred if they lead to this great and glorious goal. Cavour knows full well that after the fight before Sebastopol, sooner or later, a peace conference will have to be held. And at this peace conference, those powers will participate who have joined in the fight. True, Sardinia has no immediate concern, no direct interest at Sebastopol, but if we will help now with our fleet, we will sit at the future peace conference, enjoying equal rights with the other powers. And at this peace conference, Cavour, as the representative of Sardinia, will proclaim the free and independent United Italy. Thus our dream, for which we have suffered and died, will become, at last, a wonderful and happy reality. And if you now ask me again, what has Sardinia to do with Sevastopol, then let me tell you the following words. Like the steps of a ladder, Cavour, Sardinia, the siege of Sevastopol, the future European Peace Conference, the proclamation of a free and united Italy."
Okay, I'll continue, I guess, with this guy's story, that he's telling this story, Littman. "The whole assembly was under the spell of Nordau's beautiful, truly poetic and exalted diction and his exquisite musical French." Oh, there you go. He had exquisite musical French, adding. "Delighted."
I like Joey Bishop.
Yeah. "Delighted the hearers with an almost sensual pleasure. For a few seconds, the speaker paused. And the public, absolutely, of course, these are all Jews here, absolutely intoxicated by his splendid oratory, applauded frantically. But soon Nordau asked for silence asked for silence and continued.
Now this great progressive world power, England, has after the pogroms of Kishinev, in token of her sympathy with our poor people, offered through the Zionist Congress the autonomous colony of Uganda to the Jewish nation. Of course, Uganda is in Africa, and Africa is not Zion, and never will be Zion, to quote Herzl's own words. But Herzl knows full well that nothing is so valuable to the cause of Zionism as amicable political relations with such a power as England is, and so much more valuable as England's main interest is concentrated in the Orient, which means Middle East.
Yeah.
Nowhere else is precedent as powerful as in England. And so it is most important to accept a colony out of the hands of England and create thus a precedent in our favor. Sooner or later, the Oriental question, Middle East question, in other words, will have to be solved. And the Oriental question means, naturally, also the question of Palestine. England, who had addressed a formal political note to the Zionist Congress, which is pledged to the Basel Program, England will have the deciding voice in the final solution of the Oriental question, and Herzl has considered it his duty to maintain valuable relations with this great and progressive power. Herzl knows that we stand before a tremendous upheaval of the whole world. Soon, perhaps, some kind of a world congress will have to be called. And England, the great, free, and powerful England, will then continue the work it has begun with its generous offer to the Sixth Congress. And if you ask me now, what has Israel to do in Uganda, then let me tell you, as the answer, the words of the statesman of Sardinia, only applied to our case and given in our version. Let me tell you the following words, as if I were showing you the rungs of a ladder leading upward and upward. Herzl, the Zionistic Congress, the English-Uganda proposition, the future world war, the peace conference, where, with the help of England, a free and Jewish Palestine will be created.
Well, that's pretty darn interesting that they mention all those things, the future world war and the peace conference. Okay, then this Littman continues in his story, like the mighty thunder, these last words came to us, and we were all trembling and awestruck, as if we had seen a vision of old. And in my ears were sounding the words of our great brother, Ahad Ham, who said of Nordau's address at the First Congress, I felt that one of the great old prophets was speaking to us, that his voice came down from the free hills of Judea, and our hearts were burning in us when we heard his words, filled with wonder, wisdom, and vision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Back to the regular.
That reminds me of the way Jews talk in occupied Arab land. Can't you feel the presence of David here? Oh!
Yeah.
The amazing thing is that this article by Littman Rosenthal should ever have been permitted to see print. But it did not see print until the Balfour Declaration about Palestine. And it never would have seen print had not the Jews believed that one part of their program had been accomplished. The Jew never betrays himself until he believes that what he seeks has been won. Then he lets himself go. It was only to the Jews that the 1903 program of the latter, the future world war, the peace conference, the Jewish program, was communicated. When the ascent of that ladder seemed to be complete, then came the public talk. A similar illustration of this is to be found in the fall of the Tsar. When that event transpired, it was an occasion of great rejoicing in New York, and a Gentile of worldwide fame made a speech in which he lauded an American Jew of national reputation for having begun the downfall of the Tsar by providing the money with which propaganda had been made among Russian prisoners in Japan during the Russo-Japanese War. The story came out only after the success of the plot. It is not at all out of keeping that the last men to see the last act of the plot carried out, the actual murderer of Nicholas Romanovich, his wife, his young daughters, and his invalid boy, were five Soviet deputies, the latter five all Jews. What began with the assistance of an American financier, American Jewish financier, finished with Soviet deputies, also Jews. Did international Jews in 1903 foresee the war? This Rosenthal confession is but one bit of evidence that they did. And did they do nothing but foresee it? It were well if the facts stopped at foresight and did not run on to provocation. For the present, the reader is invited to retain in his mind 2 points in this Rosenthal article. Perhaps it will interest you to know that the right hand of Cavour, his friend and advisor, was his secretary Hartum, a Jew. This is the way the Jewish press speaks of its own. If this paper, or a Chicago paper, or a New York paper, should go through the list of the secretaries of the men of power in his world today, in the world today, and make the note after the names, his secretary a Jew, the Jewish Anti-Defamation Society would send letters of protests. There is one rule for the Gentile and one for the Jew in the Jewish mind. Well, that's an understatement. Writing in the public prints about Hartum, he would be described as an Italian.
Very good. Very good point there.
Were the Jewish secretaries who abounded before the war, during the war, and throughout the peace conference of less brilliance than Hartum? Were there not Hartums in England, France, Germany? Yes, and in Russia, too. In the United States, there were many. Who saw the program of the latter? Did Max Nordau, who saw it so clearly in 1903, forget it in 1914 and 1918? We know this. The Jews in their Congress at Basel in 1903 foresaw the future world war. How did they know it was to be a world war? We know this also. The protocols, perhaps as early as 1896, certainly not later than 1905, foresaw the policy of no annexations. The world war came to pass. No annexations came to pass. What was then future in the Jewish world program is now past. In the protocols, there are two forms of declaration. One is, we have. The other is, we shall. If somewhere in the world this summer, in the high secret spokesman, if somewhere in the world this summer, the high secret spokesman of the world program is addressing his class of international initiates, he will have to say, we have. In many places where the spokesman of 1896 said, we shall. Things have been accomplished. We will represent ourselves as the saviors of the laboring classes. That has been and is being done. We will deflect the thoughts of the Gentiles to industry and commerce. That has been done. We will create a strongly centralized administration so as to grasp all the social forces strongly in our hands. That has been done. We will adopt for ourselves the liberal side of all parties and all movements and provide orators. That has been done. We will force up wages. That has been done. We will at the same time cause a rise in the price of prime necessities. That has been done. We will also undermine the sources of production by instilling in the workmen ideas of anarchy. That has been done.
Okay, Protocol 7. To demonstrate our enslavement of the Gentile governments of Europe, we shall show our power to one by crimes of violence, that is, by a reign of terror. That's from Protocol 7.
Okay. Who that sees Russia and beholds the attitude of the premiers of England, France, and Italy toward the Soviets? The enslavement of statesmanship by a condition that tangles more gnarledly the more it is dealt with. Who that sees the prostration of Europe before a wound that is deliberately kept from healing can forbear to say, that too has been done? Our plans will not upset contemporary institutions immediately. Their management will only be altered, and consequently the whole procedure of their activity will thus be directed according to plans laid down by us. That has been done. We shall saddle the press and keep a tight rein upon it. That has been done. The rein is being strongly pulled in the United States at this moment, as many an editor can testify. Even if there should be those who desire to write against us, no one will print it. No one will print their writings. In large part, that has been done. It has been done completely with the profit-making press. We shall, as an incentive to speculation, encourage among the Gentiles a strong demand for luxuries, all enticing luxuries. That has been done. To each act of opposition, we must be in a position to respond by bringing on war through the neighbors of any country that dares to oppose us. And if these neighbors should plan to stand collectively against us, we must let loose a world war. From Protocol 7. The term world war is the same as that used by Rosenthal and Nordau. Herzl knows, said Nordau in 1903, that we stand before a tremendous upheaval of the whole world. We must create unrest, dissension, and mutual animosities throughout Europe and with the help of her relationships on other continents. This has been done. This passage continues. There is a double advantage in this. First, we shall command the respect of all countries by this method, for they will realize that we have the power to create disorder or establish order at will. This, too, has been done. Truly did the spokesman of 1896 speak of those momentous occurrences of the near future toward which we are rushing in a stream of great crises. Not only was no annexations achieved as far as possible, just as the protocols outlined it, but a host of other plans have been matured in achievement along with it. No annexations as a matter of political morality is one thing, and no annexations for the reason that this will shift war to an economic footing and nations will perceive the strength of our superiority in the aid we render is quite another thing. The world was with the no annexations program as a matter of political morality. The other program, which used this morality as its vehicle, was hidden.
Okay, adding. Okay, we got 30 seconds. We've got one long paragraph.
Okay, let me read that real fast.
Okay.
There are still other matters in this group which must receive attention, but another article will be necessary to do it. In the meantime, it is natural to wonder whether, with the program as outlined in this report of the protocols, having received fulfillment in so many particulars, a new protocol or a further unfolding of the latter has been made by the wise men to their initiates, and whether any additional unveiling will ever come to the knowledge of the world. It would seem that a proper estimate of the knowledge now available would lead to such an awakening as to nullify the present program and make all future ones impossible. But Gentiles like their ease, and Judah is beckoned on.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.